The Green Knight. We've been waiting for this movie for a long time. It came out last month. It is everything I had hoped it would be. And we have a really long post on No Film School. If you really want to dive into the meaning, the history, the detail, craftsmanship, there's just so much going on in this film that is just excellent. And I recommend you watch it, see it, think about it, read up on it, discuss it. But today we have a treat because we have cinematographer Andrew Draws Palermo, who shot The Green Knight, collaborated with David Lowry over the course of years because this film was delayed due to COVID, which gave them an opportunity to reflect, collaborate, look back, and change a lot of what the movie was. So we talk about all that and more today in my interview with Andrew on the No Film School podcast. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
Great. I'm so glad. I'm so glad we could do this. I love the movie, and I was really looking forward to talking to you about it. And yeah, it's been out. People are seemingly enjoying it.
And baffled by it equally, it seems, which I'm so happy to see. And it's stimulating some interesting conversations and familial battles, it seems.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, look, that's why I wanted so badly. Like, I started contacting PR about talking to some people from this film, you guys, as soon as I heard about it before South By in 2020. So, like, I was like, oh my God, they're making a Green Knight movie? Like, I'm all about it. Like, I love it.
Amazing. So,
and the response has been great. And I agree. I think it's great that people are baffled by it. I want to talk to you about, obviously, the photography. It's a beautiful movie. It's a unique looking movie. And there's a lot there. But I'm really curious, you know, kind of going back and looking at your career a little bit in general, because we have some time, like, what got you on this project? And you've done a lot of shorts, you've done a lot of docs. Like, is this one of your first features as a DP, second feature, some in the first five-ish? I'm looking at your resume.
Yeah, I think this is number seven, I believe.
Okay, so I was off.
Six or seven, yeah. No, it's fine. So, you know, before this film, had DP'd a few and directed a few, couple, I should say. And in the last maybe 5 or 6 years, I've pretty much zeroed in on just DPing and not directing anymore myself. And in 2017, I shot a film for David, which is our first collaboration together, called A Ghost Story. We really hit it off and had a great time on that movie. And I think we're both proud of the way that movie turned out. And after that, he and I did a television show together called Strange Angel. And I think somewhere towards the end of that show, he mentioned that he wanted to make a medieval epic. And, you know, would I be interested in reading it? And of course, I really, really enjoy working with David. He's just such a kind person and also not too self-serious, despite being incredibly smart, talented. He has fun with himself. And I really appreciate that in a person, that, you know, you can laugh at yourself. And so that's just to say that, of course, I would read it. I loved it. His scripts always are fun to read. They're rich. There's sometimes some interesting camera direction within the scripts, and that can be fun for me to start to imagine. You know, I said, of course, absolutely, I'm on board wherever you need me. And then in August, we started scouting the film, August of 2017, I believe. And that was sort of the real kickoff.
Wow. August of 2017. So not long
after. It's a long time in the making. Yeah.
Yeah. Not long after Ghost Story was out there and before Strange Angel. Like, around all this was all happening.
Does Strange Angel say, do you have IMDb up presently? Does Strange Angel say 2018? I may have that wrong.
Yeah.
I have to admit, I may have that wrong by 1 year.
That's okay.
We would have shot in 2019. Yeah, so we scouted in August of 2018. It would have been after Strange Angel.
Okay, got it. And then you shot in 2019, and then supposed to release in 2020. And then the world crumbled in a weird way. And now we release in 2021. Yes. So did you have any experience or knowledge of Arthurian myth or the Green Knight itself? But prior
none
to
of the Yeah, none of The Green Knight. I'd never even heard of it. You know, I'd mentioned it to a few friends early on. Oh my God, you know, that's one of my favorite stories. And my mom used to read it to me, or I loved it in college, would everyone say, or, you know, I had a friend who's an editor. He would say, you know, the hunts are amazing. It's what the whole thing is about, these hunts. And I was like, oh, wow, it's incredible. I'm so interested to how many people had known about it. But for me, King Arthur and Knights of the Round Table is, you know, a largely film world story for me. I didn't really read Arthurian lore.
Sure.
Of course, I was, as a kid, a huge fan of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And
sure, yeah.
You know, we and watched I think David Excalibur a lot. And
yeah. Right. And David's talked about those being like kind of baked in there somewhere as you know, the experience of them.
Yeah.
But visually, this movie, The Green Knight, is very separate from other versions we've seen, like Excalibur, mm-hmm. which is the kind of the John Borman one. It really focuses on Arthur himself and is way more mm-hmm. visually like, well, it's its own, it's from its era, but it's got a kind of a magicalness to the visuals, right? And my sense was you guys went for something more grounded and historical looking. Am I correct in that? Mm. Like kind of at times.
Yeah, I think that's accurate at times. And then in other times I feel, you know, we took the license to go there a little more magical with our limited means, you know? So what we had in Stripes were, and we could go to beautiful Irish landscapes and, you know, we'd have something when we were done, you know, we could roll the camera and we would have it. Whereas I think a film like Borman's Excalibur, you know, they were building a lot of sets, and actually they used the same studio that we had in Wicklow, Ireland, which is a funny bit of overlap, and kind of felt great to be, you know, walking on the shoulders of those giants and or with them at our side in a way. And actually, I think my gaffer was the son of the gaffer of Excalibur, which was kind of
That's really
other
cool.
Funny little
bit was of it a local lap, crew?
But largely local crew, except for some of the heads of department, myself, costume designer and production designer, both American. But yeah, I mean, I think you're right to point out that it is grounded at times. Like, I really wanted it to feel wet and sticky and, you know, feel the fog and feel the wind, and I really wanted to know what it felt like to be on a journey in a really intimate sense. And I think to do that, you can't be fully in a magical world, or it just doesn't feel real. It doesn't feel grounded.
Yeah.
And so there was definitely some of that, but then there's also some of the magic that I think is within that world as well.
Oh yeah, definitely. And the further you get into the story, the more there's magic. I mean, early on, there's some magic, right? Almost immediately. But it happens in a way that I don't know what the adjectives to use are, but it happens in a way, like for me as a viewer, the movie opens and I'm looking at that era in a way that feels so, like you said, wet. I mean, a stone building.
I think the thing that garden. I love, and the thing that I like even about the magic, and was something that we were eager to do, was how do you make it feel earthy? Even though they are doing magic, these witches, the leaf which grows after they plant the rune into the ground, you know, I saw various iterations of that, and it just never felt tactile enough. It always kind of felt a little magical, like a little too CG, a little too beautiful. And David and I kept saying we wanted it to feel like a stop motion or a time lapse of a plant growing, so that it's kind of shaky as it's going, and that it feels a little handcrafted, almost that it was like stop motion. And I think Nicholas Bateman was the one that cracked that finally. And I just love that visual effect of that leaf growing, because it's that tactile feeling that I love and was after, and just he nailed it.
Yeah, you remind me or highlight something about my experience of it, which was that it all felt a little ancient, even in the magic. Like it felt like something that was a little old and of the of that world that's hard to decode, which is fun. The clock stuff, the puppets, or the little show, you know, that all felt like kind of tactile, like you said, like of that world. The sash, which is, you know, when you make a magical item, in a story like that, like in Excalibur, the sword, they didn't use CG at the time, but the sword is like shiny with lens flare, like, and the armor is like bright, you know? And so they used things to create that. But you guys, I feel like you went another way with those things where you tried to say, we're going to earth them up somehow, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, that sash was primarily the brainchild of our costume designer, Mount Goja. And I really loved the way that she made the interior of that sash. It felt like intestines or something, or some kind of like, it felt bloody on the inside before, when they wrapped it up. And then, you know, we used real gold or golden thread, and that felt nice to see sort of in macro as they're stringing it in that montage. And we just set that scene up where those women basically just made that in front of us, you know, a couple takes. And I just set the camera on a little jib and tracked along, and I could go down from the rune as they were wrapping it in the sash and then tying it up, and, you know, watching them tamp in some gold. And, you know, that in that way, it just kind of felt like we were capturing a process, which they were, in fact, making the sash in another sort of, as you're suggesting, more grounded, as opposed to fully magical, something that, you know, might have been CG in a different movie.
Yeah.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Oh, and what camera did you shoot on?
We shot on the Alexa 65 with Arri DNA lenses and some Tokinas in there as well. And
what was the decision process like for you and David, like talking about medium and, you know, what were the considerations and what landed you there?
David, I think, came to the project with large format in mind. Like, I think in our very first conversations, he wanted a large format movie. He threw down a really interesting challenge, which I don't know that I ever fully understood his meaning, nor did he necessarily understand the ask. But he said that he wanted this movie to feel 3D without being 3D. And I'd kind of tease at that every so often. And I'd pose a question, do you mean like this? Or do you mean like that? And for me, that started to feel more and more like I wanted very wide, very dynamic frames where something could be large in the foreground, although our subject might be small in the midground, so that there would always be a push and pull about size within the frame, even though everything could be sharp from edge to edge. And that sort of got us on a path talking about Times at Midnight, which is a very beautiful, very beautifully lensed movie and very dynamically framed and composed film. And
so
I
mean, sharp,
I think that
focus
was kind of
throughout,
like where we started, which ended up not being film. I mean, the film is quite soft in many scenes, but it was something about the size within the frames, that something could feel large, you know, and dynamically framed close in our foreground, was kind of like where I took that challenge that he laid down. I'd actually
interesting
love to ask
yeah
him about it. Did he feel like we achieved that goal or not?
It's funny, I
knew what the question was.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it now in a different way. I'm trying to recall I love that I got to see it in a theatrical setting. I think that the movie needs that. I mean, I'd love all movies to be seen that way, but this one feels like it was made for that to me. Not just in terms of the scope, it sounds like, in terms of big frames and how you did the frame, but the sound as well. I'm curious how much some of the sound design and some of the intents there, because the sound in this movie is really rich.
I don't know. It's very rich. That's exactly how I would have described it. Yeah. It's you know, I talked with Daniel, the composer, a little bit in advance and asked early in pre-pro if there was any kind of music he was already kicking around in his mind, or maybe he had already done a little stuff. And, you know, he started a playlist with myself and David on Spotify, and we just kind of swap some moods. And some of that music was contemporary, but kind of got me into a mood. We kind of took it as a something to think about sonically, because I think sound and music are so important to the pace of the imagery. And I think that really helps me to get into a vibe. But as far as like how the Green Knight sounded, I didn't know necessarily how substantive he might sound, but I had a feeling, and I think I knew perhaps that there was going to be a lot of these kind of creaks and cracks.
Yeah.
And but the bass and body that they bring into that is just so wonderful and makes him such a character that is different than the character I was experiencing on set, because Ralph is such a lovely, kind man. And the Green Knight actually kind of is oddly winking and kind and sneaky and fun in that way too. But the body of him, the weight and how ancient he feels, I feel is, you know, all done in sound. And it's just incredible.
It's a fascinating thing to hear that, because we only experience the finished thing. And it feels like this excellent marriage between what you captured visually and then these sounds that augment it and the two things weave together. It's very much this experience of this other world, like this historic mythic world that it's amazing. But hearing you say like it wasn't at all the vibe on set is amazing, because it seems to work so well.
You know, it's like you see like behind the scenes of like some sci-fi movie where you know, some space capsule door opens and on set it's a little gas canister going, but on the movie they've got all these kind of gears and often you forget. And but it's so great to hear a sound, because it really does add such a character.
I think your imagination as a cinematographer helps, because you have to be able to have that something, you have to be able to hold something.
That experience,
definitely. And then they layer that icing on top of your cake. You know what I mean? Like, you have to bake that cake knowing that there's going to be icing later.
That's a nice way of saying it. Yeah, I mean, you always... when the Green Knight's present, the camera's always looking up at him and how immense he is. And, you know, that is sort of the most foundational thing I can do visually.
I'm really want to know a little bit about what the mood board was, both in like what specific sounds you were taking inspiration from, but also like what did you guys use as your visual mood board in general? Like, what were your inspiration sources?
Yeah,
for lighting? Let me just say the lighting in the castle. When Lady Bertilac delivers that probably most important speech to me in the movie about green, like the symbolism of it. It's just beautiful. It's like candlelit lighting.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that scene I have to say was pretty directly inspired by the Russian film War and Peace. I had seen it early in pre-production, and there's one scene in particular that was kind of sticking in my head as something to crib. And our scene looks nothing like it in the end, I think, from the still that I had pulled. But there's a little bit of trickery in that too, that I showed to my wife, who is also a filmmaker, that she didn't notice it either, which I just love that it's sneaking by. But if you watch one of her very longest shots, and you watch it from the very top to the bottom, if you went A to B, you went from end to out point, you would see that I, over the course of the entire shot, brought in this vignette so that the entire background fades away and that the woman who's sitting next to her with the blindfold becomes completely gone. And you can't really feel it because it's such a long shot and it's slowly coming in, but that gaze that she's giving us, you know, piercing eyes, it's sort of, I feel, what Gawain's feeling is the world is just dropping out and he is just looking at this woman giving this just absolutely horrifying speech. And that's some of my favorite photography in the film. I was trying to think like what other films, you know, there's some, we really liked Willow. We talked about Willow some. I'm just actually scrubbing back through my book. Generally, my lookbooks are built first from my scout photos, things that I'm experiencing and what I'm liking, what I'm not. And it's kind of like notes to myself. But then I kind of get into some things that I'm interested in. I have Flesh and Blood in here. I have some Rembrandt paintings. I have a film called The Valley of the Bees, which is a real stunner. Some paintings by DeWitt and Friedrich. I have a film called The Devils and Willow, which I mentioned.
Willow is an interesting one. As you say it, I realize, there is a little bit of that. Yeah, I think
and actually the ones that I pulled are all the matte paintings. It's all of these shots that are tiny characters within a massive landscape. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that I think were done all with glass matte paintings. You know, there's one in particular where they're crossing a little bit, you know, crossing a bridge with a great chasm underneath them. And I think that is, you know, full matte painting, as are some of the other ones as well, but you know, some high art and low art.
Yeah. You guys, created, this is an interesting thing. I don't know the budget. I know that this wasn't a massive, you know, this is an epic and it's an adventure story and it's high concept and all that. And it's historical. And yet, you know, I think it was modest by comparison to like tent poles typically. And it feels big because I think filmmakers can do a lot more with canvas and with epic and space. And I think this movie is a really good example. And when you talk about that specific, you know, the matte paintings, the small pieces in the big spaces, I was struck immediately when he leaves the castle or he leaves Camelot, he's in a big space and the world feels real big and real scary.
Yeah.
and when he meets the kid in the war, like what were the conversations creatively, not just visually, like where is he? What part of the England is that? Did you talk about those kinds of things?
That was in Wicklow, Ireland. The one where he's leaving Camelot. We shot in up in sort of a high area called the Featherbeds, which that little path was, you know, I think kind of just a walking path or mainly also just paths that sheep took. And so it kind of been run down by sheep. Mm. But it's, you know, really beautiful high mountain kind of area. And, you know, we just went out there with Dev on a horse and a camera on a truck basically. And just tried to make that shot as long as we could make it basically. And the way that Dev's posture changes over the course of that shot, I think it's just beautiful. And he, you know, he's coming out and he's so proud and he's not even engaging with those kids because he thinks he's just too cool. And then by the end of that sort of farmer, you can just start to feel his posture. He's just curling in on himself. He's terrified. And that's kind of the movie in a nutshell in one shot, which, you know, it's so fun to shoot those kinds of shots. Cause when you get it and you have it, you just feel it's just, you can't do it again, you know, it. And sometimes on set, you know, on the 16th take, you might get something, but then the director wants to go again to work on something else, or maybe the cast wants to go again to work on something. But when you have a shot like that and you get it, it just feels so great. It feels, you just, everyone's so excited. Everyone knows we got it and that we all together achieved the shot. And the same is sort of true with that, like 360 where Dev is replaced by a skeleton and then returns. We actually had to kind of do a little dance with the camera and placing that skeleton and then Dev and the grip who was pushing the camera. And, you know, we were rotating it on a remote head, but the feeling that, oh my God, we got it. You laid down exactly in the right place. And, you know, his little scramble across the moss was, you know, great. It's just that feeling amongst a crew is just so wonderful.
I was going to ask as soon as you were talking about Wonders, I was like, I wonder if they really did that in one. And you told me. You answered before I asked. But that part is great. And there's, I want to ask about, like, as we, you know, this is the big question and everyone will be discussing and debating, but how much did you and David and Dev and everybody else involved talk about meaning of the story or of, you know, the film deviates a little from the original, but amazingly, not all that much. And yet, you know, we don't really know entirely what the original story means. We don't know all the symbols of that era. There's lots of interpretations. Did you guys talk about stuff in those terms ever? And what did you talk about?
Definitely. Yeah, we definitely did. I mean, I think a lot of the character motivations were discussed. You know, an actor, I think, often wants to understand how to paint the scene with their performance. And, you know, hearing how he would discuss that with Sarita was also a really interesting thing to overhear, you know, who plays Morgan Le Fay. And Deb's mother in the film. And her character was often a discussion, especially once there's a rough cut. And we, as part of our process that David likes to do, and I hope that every filmmaker would have the chance to do what he does, which is to shoot a movie, have a rough cut, take a look at it, look at the land and say, you know, if I want to push this portion of the movie, I will go back. When we go back to shoot a bit more, I'm going to pick up some things that really, really add some dimension to this portion. And so after seeing that first cut, I think all the heads of department saw it together, and it was great to sit in a room and all of us just have completely different interpretations of the movie.
Amazing. You know,
even though we all set out to make the same movie on the paper and to kind of get a little heated about it, I think, you know, some discussions, some views were not as well received as other, you know, like we all kind of were pitting each against each other, but of course, all out of love. Like, no, it's this. Yeah. We should focus on this. And David just sits there quietly and just is soaking it all in. My read is a lot about Morgan Le Fay, I think, and kind of like the great lengths that a parent goes to get, you know, to get a child to become a better person. But I also really was like, maybe the cut that we were discussing also was very heavy on stuff with Alicia Vikander as the prostitute in the brothel. And I was really struck by that love and how I think I really wanted to shoot more of this, what I was calling a love story in some ways. And perhaps wrongfully so, and perhaps not, you know, maybe just not the film that David wanted to make or whatever. But we had certainly a lot more material of that. But I was really struck by the pain of seeing her in that montage at the end of the film.
Yes.
And when they lock eyes and how powerful that is. And I think David, rightfully so, we didn't need much more. You know, it was there. Eventually, the way in which it all got kind of woven into the film, and then even a flashback later, which was never in the cut that I saw originally, you know, the cut we were first discussing, where, you know, when he rings the bell and you kind of flash back to her and you can hear her a bit more, you know, once he left the castle originally, we never saw her again until the very end. So some of that did get a little peppered in there, but it's just fascinating to hear all the reads of it.
No, I mean, I
got an email from my sister just this evening, and she, you know, she has a really funny read of it and how humorous the film was, which I love because I think it's a very funny film at times too, but that my dad also saw, who's this, he's pretty conservative. And, you know, I was so excited to hear what he might have to say just because I knew it was going to be classic and funny. but she said that he just had no fucking idea what the movie was about. And she said, you know, that's okay. That's kind of, it was that way by design. I just love that. He's just like, what the fuck is my son making?
It's one of the oldest stories that exists. Like, it's basically like as core as it gets. I mean, it's open to interpretation. There are things like you say, she's a prostitute in a brothel. Even that's not entirely spelled out. I mean, it's clear, but it's not. Morgan Le Fay as his mother is an invention of this version. She's his aunt.
Original. Our version.
The prostitute. Yeah. Like, and I remember, you know, I saw it and I was like, oh, that is a really powerful choice to make her his mother, to make the story closer to being a mother trying to force a son to come of age is a whole take unto itself. And I find that fascinating. And the idea that you guys all sat in a room and discussed interpretations of a movie you'd made and disagreed, and the director weighed it all in his next cut is like a beautiful filmmaking story. I gotta say, like, it's awesome. I love that there was time to do that. And I'd love to know more about what changed or what you guys saw and you thought, we should really push here, pull there, you know, like this is, I mean, yeah, that's just that whole montage at the end that where he sees what could be is amazing.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a different way of telling you your answer is that there are a few scenes which I don't think David changed a single frame of, which to me are like some of the strongest scenes. Mm-hmm. And it's really telling, you know, the ways in which filmmaking can come together just for all the right reasons. You know, all the reasons just kind of land into place. And it's just, it takes so much to make a good scene, and it takes so much to have a good shoot day. You know, so many things need to go right. But the scene with St. Winifred, where he goes into her cottage and the whole scene outside, all of that was nearly frame by frame from his very first cut directly into the final cut, as well as that montage at the end, which you're mentioning. There's not a single shot in there that was picked up at a later date or changed from his very first cut. I mean, it was just so locked down from the very beginning. And that those we always thought as these are the highlights of the movie, and how do we continue to make the movie this strong in other places?
Nice. Yeah, that montage is the heart and soul in a way. It's the moral. And that Winifred thing is great because it's another myth from the region that it would have been. It's great. History. Yeah. I mean, the nerd in me about this stuff loves that. Yeah, and it was also funny. There was comedy in that.
Yeah. Yeah. The line, the way that she delivers the, why would you ask me that? I just love the way how she just stands up for her. So how could you ever ask me that? It's just incredible. The very first time I shot her actually was on a camera test, and I was already testing how she might float, which is a simple, you know, old trick, which is she just stands on a piece of track and I set a little platform for her and the grips are just below pushing her on a platform. But the very, very first time that I shot her, she was, I think she already had the dress on that she's wearing, but she's just chewing bubble gum. And so she's just floating along like a ghost, but chewing bubble gum. And it's the collision there. It's just so incredible. I need to try to find that clip at some
That's
point.
That's some Monty Python.
It's so funny.
That's Monty Python.
Yeah, it's
Holy
incredible.
Cow right there. Yeah. All right. Well, I've been told we're running out. I could have gone on forever. Thank you so much. The movie's great.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate it. I'm so glad someone who cares so deeply about it was into the film. So thank you so much.
Yes. All right. We'll talk soon. Good luck.
Bye. Cheers.
Thank you so much, Andrew, for coming on the podcast. Thank you for listening. I really hope you see The Green Knight or saw it. I'm glad you listened. I'm a big fan of movies that make you think, engage, discuss, and reflect. I think that's what audiences crave on some level. And I think it makes for better storytelling because it's the core of what the art is. It's reflective, it's thoughtful, and this film is also beautiful. I just think on every level, they did a great job engaging with us, engaging with our senses. I can't say enough about the visuals, the audio mixing is just excellent. So thanks again, and hope to hear from you soon.